And we're talking about floating offshore wind.
Floating offshore wind.
So what's all that about?
It's much deeper water, so therefore it lends itself very nicely to this new technology.
But I'm going to say a turbine on a boat here.
Whereas we're looking at floating wind is breaking totally new ground.
What's the opportunity here?
And the opportunity is huge globally with the hundreds and hundreds of gigawatts that we could deploy here. And
I'm going to ask a stupid question now. I can't believe it's taken me so long to ask. How does a floating wind turbine not fall over?
It's kind of the catalyst, I would say, for floating wind in the Celtic Sea. So
you construct it onshore and like it also in a shipyard and then tow it out.
Yeah.
Nuts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely nuts.
Yeah. My favourite fact about a 15 megawatt turbine is that one rotation of a turbine can power a house for 2 days.
Hey everybody, Izzy, the Modo podcast producer here. Because of holidays and clashes this week, I'm introducing today's episode. This one is a Modo Selects, and we are revisiting a conversation from last year with Kerry Hayes from Simply Blue Group. In it, her and Q talk about floating wind. Kerry is a massive advocate and hugely passionate about floating wind and how it can be used to open up a load of the ocean's resources. As Q would say, don't forget to hit like, subscribe, and all of those other good buttons. It really means the world to us. Let's jump in.
Hello, Kerry. Hello. Right. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to Modo. Welcome to Birmingham. We did just mention, it's probably worth saying for the podcast, there's a lot of shouty men outside doing stag do. So if you're listening to the podcast and you can hear testosterone in your ears, then it's not us. Well, it's no, certainly not me anyway.
Certainly not me. No, lacking in testosterone.
And Kerry Hayes, why are we talking?
Why are we talking?
Who are you and where are you from?
So who am I? My name's Kerry Hayes, as you just said, and I work for a company called Simply Blue Group.
Mm-hmm.
And Simply Blue Group is an early stage blue economy developer. And by that, I mean we get involved in lots of good projects that use our oceans. So my main area of focus is around floating offshore wind, but the company does lots of cool things in aquaculture, sustainable aquaculture.
Aquaculture?
Yes. Yeah,
that's a cool new word. Yeah. We've never had that on the podcast before.
So lots of stuff there. We're doing some stuff around seaweed and trying to sort of grow that more sustainably as a food source. We do some wave energy stuff. So we do all sorts of things and we're constantly evolving. But our kind of main ethos is doing really good stuff with the oceans. So I work on our floating wind side of things. I've been with the company since August of last year. And before that, I worked with a company called Regen, who I think Modo are familiar with.
Yeah, props to Regen.
Yeah,
we love Regen. Thanks to Regen. Fighting the good fight.
They're a brilliant team of people doing exactly as you say, fighting the good fight. So I was there with them for 10 years. I started as an 8-week intern and poor old Merlin at Regen couldn't get rid of me. So
that seems to happen quite a lot, right?
Yeah.
It's
a great way to bring people into the sector, though, to start up as, you know, as an intern and then work your way up and earn your stripes. But before that, and the reason I'm in floating wind now, my background, I did an oceanography degree and then a master's in marine renewable energy. So I like to say, and I've never been tested on this or had my theory disproved anyway, mm-hmm. I like to think I'm one of the few people or one of the earliest adopters of people who actually studied to do what I'm doing now, rather than lots of people in the energy sector have come from
bandwagons.
Different.
Everyone's jumping on this ocean. Like, what did you say?
What's this now?
What's the word that we just said for the first time? Ocean?
Aquaculture.
Aquaculture, yeah. Bandwagon,
so
yeah.
Lots of people moving around from different things. So I actually sort of specifically wanted to get into this. So I was at Regen doing all sorts of stuff around floating offshore wind initially, because Regen was one of the first companies to identify the opportunities for floating offshore wind in areas such as the Celtic Sea. And I'll explain what I mean by the Celtic Sea in a moment. So I did quite a lot of work with them on all sorts of stuff there, bounced around a bit, did some stuff on heat networks, did some innovative solar stuff. I left Regen for a time and went to do wave and tidal development. Didn't quite go to plan. Unfortunately, did get made redundant after a couple of months.
Oh, sorry, I wasn't laughing at not going to plan. I was laughing at this. Just tidal's hard, isn't it?
Tidal is really hard.
There's so many smart people trying to make that thing work.
It is hard.
And it's very tricky.
And I think it will happen. And I hold, you know, confidence in the smart people, like you say, but it is tricky. There's some really complex conditions that need to come together to make it work. And by definition of, if you're, you know, you're putting a turbine out there to extract tidal energy, that's in some of the harshest conditions and stuff. So
yeah,
it's a challenge. So then I went back to Regen after a year of doing a few other little bits and bobs. Regen took me back, and so I was there for another 5 years before I left to join Simply Blue Group, who I had been keeping an eye on for quite some time because they are, we are, I guess, now that I work for them, a really exciting company who are entrepreneurial, kind of startup mentality. So just flying off in different directions to do all good things, and everything is mission driven.
How big is Simply Blue?
Yeah, so last time I checked, and I say that because it changes all the time, I think we're sitting at just over 60 people now.
Okay.
When I joined, I think I was employee number 45, 46, something like that. So that was August last year. So we've had quite a rapid expansion before since then. Before the pandemic started, I think we were around 8, 9, 10 people.
Okay.
So the vast majority of the expansion has been since the start of 2020. We are based all over the world now. So I work out of our Cornwall office, which is in Newquay, which is a great place to have an office.
Yeah, not bad.
And I am recruiting and desperately trying to recruit. So if anyone
here comes
wants to
the
come and
plug.
Work.
Yeah, so if you've got a shark fish hanging around your neck, then perhaps
apply
for a job.
If you like going to work in flip-flops and going for surf Wednesdays, then I am trying to recruit. So I'm in our Cornwall office, and we've got offices all over the place. So we've got one up in Scotland. We've got one over in Pembroke in Wales. We've got 3 or 4 offices in Ireland now, in Dublin, Cork, and a place called Ardmore, which is where one of our founders is from. Very beautiful part of the country. And then we've also got an office in Oregon in America. And we've now got people being employed all over the world where we're looking at new markets. We're picking people to lead those markets and opening up new offices.
So Simply Blue is everywhere, like the ocean, right? And so you guys develop lots of stuff. We're going to talk about a specific type of offshore wind today, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about floating offshore wind.
Floating offshore wind.
So what's all that about?
Yeah. So floating offshore wind, it essentially uses existing turbines that you will recognise from any offshore wind farm in the country or off the country, actually, more specifically. But it uses a different type of mechanism to attach the seabed, to attach the turbines to the seabed. So whereas all of the turbines that you would recognise around the coast, pretty much all of them are monopiled, which means they're drilled into the seabed. That has some limitations to it in that you can't really drill much more than somewhere but 30, 40 metres. The reason I'm sort of hesitant there is there's some debate in the industry about how deep you can go with monopiles, but broadly speaking, 30, 40 metres, you've kind of got to your limit there.
So like a pile in the ground onshore.
Yes.
You put a big pile in the ground offshore. Just there's a lot of water on top.
There's a lot of water on top, and you've got to drill quite deep. And it can be a bit more challenging environmentally. Clearly, no project gets built unless it's gone through a rigorous environmental impact assessment and has achieved its development consent order. So there's lots of checks in place to make sure that they aren't causing unnecessary harm to the environment. However, by definition, if you're going to piling into the seabed, it's likely to be slightly more disruptive.
And so at the moment, so just coming back to monopile for a second, so we're talking about big bits of metal and concrete going deep, deep, deep into the seabed and putting a turbine on top.
Yeah.
And that's the current way of doing it.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of reasons why that it is great, but also might not be so good for... Well, you can't go that deep, right? And also, it's not particularly good for the seabed. So then someone came along and said, well, I'm going to say a turbine on a boat here.
Turbine on a boat.
Someone said, why don't we make this thing float?
Yeah.
So how does that work?
So it's essentially, this isn't new, doing floating structures. The oil and gas industry has been doing it for years and years and years. So it's essentially borrowing ideas from the oil and gas sector. And instead of having the monopiled solution, as we said, there's many different ways of doing it, but you'll have some form of structure with the turbine placed on it that then is anchored to the seabed using drag embedment. So it kind of catches into the seabed rather than as being drag embedment. Yeah. And I'm not an engineer, so don't push me on exactly how it works, but you'll have chains that come off the platform and are then moored to the seabed using the drag embedment anchors. So it's much more environmentally friendly and you can go much deeper.
Okay. So big floating bit of metal.
Yeah.
And then anchored in multiple places to the seabed.
Yeah.
And then you stick a turbine on top.
Stick a turbine on top. It's really easy. I don't know what my engineering colleagues are whinging about.
And it must move about a little bit, right?
Yeah, there is some movement in it because it's not sort of rigidly fixed to that. And it creates some challenges, and there's lots of innovation opportunities there to ensure that the dynamic cables can handle all that motion, although there's quite a lot of motion with fixed projects anyway, but there's lots of innovation.
That's true, there. Right? So on the seabed, you've got all these cables, and the tide moves them around anyway.
Yeah.
So even interconnectors sometimes can shift off.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got into floating wind because essentially my founder, one of my founders, Sam Marsh Perks, was particularly passionate about wave energy initially and really wanted to make that work, and we still do wave now. But he also was looking at the Celtic Sea, which is the second time I've mentioned it, and I still haven't explained exactly where it is. And given we're recording this in Birmingham, which is nowhere near the sea, I probably should explain the Celtic Sea.
No, keep teasing. No. What on earth is the Celtic? It's a sea full of Celts.
So he spotted that the Celtic Sea was this opportunity where we don't have any floating offshore wind. We don't have any offshore wind in the Celtic Sea, whereas in the North Sea, there's this huge amount of offshore wind deployed. And it's much deeper water, so therefore it lends itself very nicely to this new technology.
So it's not on the east side, it's on the west side?
It's on the west side. So it's the bit of sea that goes from sort of Cornwall, covers the Devon coast and up to the bottom of, halfway up Ireland, and covers Wales in there as well. So it's like a backwards C shape on this side, the west side of the country.
So below the Irish Sea?
Yeah, below the Irish Sea.
I worked in the Irish Sea for a while.
Right, okay.
But gas, not that was the olden days,
okay.
Right?
You've converted now.
Yeah, I'm converted. So it's below the Irish Sea.
Yeah,
I'd be interested to know where it comes in the shipping forecast. But I'm sure someone can tell us in the comments. So, and that's a particularly deep part of the sea, but particularly good for wind.
Yeah,
very windy.
It's very windy. Got very constant wind speeds there, and it is deep. It's deeper water, but most of the oceans in the world are deeper than the east coast of the UK, which is where most of the fixed turbines that we've got are, which is around up to the 30-40 metre mark. But most of the world oceans, I think it's 80% of the world's oceans, are deeper than
that. Okay, so let's sense check this for a second. So the North Sea, for example, we've got chains everywhere.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
I'm bashing
North Sea, so we're saying that these monopile, the current way that's done, monopile in the North Sea is quite, the bits that they're on is only up to 40 metres. In some cases, it's like 10, 20 metres, right?
Yeah,
it's actually pretty,
some of them are pretty close to the shore and not very deep, yeah.
And what? So for anybody who's listening to this, I'm not gonna tell you what 10 metres is, right? Or 20 metres, but it's not that deep.
It's not very deep.
And so what's the limit of what you can do with a monopile?
With a monopile, I think up to, there is debate as to where that frontier changes between fixed and between a monopile and a floating turbine. I think I'm fairly confident to say up to 40 metres would be a max. 30, 40. Somebody will correct me if I'm wrong.
And that means you've got all this ocean out there.
Yeah.
You can't put these things in.
Yeah.
Right? So hence floating.
Hence floating.
And so we'll come back to the Celtic Sea because it's so on topic at the moment. So the Celtic Sea, how many wind turbines can you get out there? How much wind energy is there to get?
A good question. And there are lots of estimates out there. I think the Offshore Renewable Energy Catapult reckon that you could get 50 gigawatts out there. We haven't yet proven that by starting with some of these projects, but potentially up to 50 gigawatts could be realizable. And just for context on that, we've got, I think we're on about 12 gigawatts of installed capacity around the UK at the moment. And that's taken us, since the early 2000s to get to where we are now. So to consider that we could have, many times that in the Celtic Sea is pretty amazing. At the moment, people are, we're, the way Simply Blue delivers projects is by forming joint ventures. So we decide that we want to do a project, we do a lot of the early works, make sure that it's, that we think it's deliverable. And then we join up with a big strategic that can help us do this. So we can bring the entrepreneurial local angle to the projects, and then we bring somebody in. And one of our joint ventures, of which we've got many, is with Total Energies, and we've got the Blue Gem Wind Partnership. Now, the Blue Gem Wind Partnership has got a lease has got a seabed lease from the Crown Estate to deliver a 100 megawatt project.
Okay.
And that's for the Erebus project. So I split my time at Simply Blue on our pipeline of new opportunities, where I work entirely for Simply Blue Group. And then I'm the policy engagement manager for the Blue Gem project, where we're trying to deliver the Erebus project.
Okay.
So that project is going to
hopefully...
I've got two hats. But that project, while 100 megawatts doesn't sound like very much, given that fixed wind projects are, you know, in development for well over a gig, it's going to be, when it's built, it'll be the biggest floating wind project in the world, hoping to be built, you know, building out and constructing in 2026.
Okay.
And that is going to be, it's kind of the catalyst, I would say, for floating wind in the Celtic Sea. So we got that lease a couple of years ago through the hard work and determination of my founders and the early team. And that sort of kickstarted this, the leasing processes that are going to come forward in the Celtic Sea.
So you guys, by 2026, are going to get 100 megawatts of floating wind turbines in the Celtic Sea.
Yeah, off Wales.
So off Wales, chained to the seabed and operational. Can we get an idea of scale of this? Does floating mean you can go bigger? Or is that a misconception?
I think, well, we're looking at the same turbines that the fixed industry is looking at the moment. So, you know, our Erebus project is going to use turbines of about 15 megawatts, which is...
Oh, my days.
They're huge.
I thought like the 3.6s were big.
Yeah, these are huge turbines.
Yeah.
They're bigger than the Gherkin, you know, when they're in London. So they're pretty, or maybe just about the same size, I forget exactly.
But there's a picture that they're offshore and people can't go and walk up to them and get an idea of the scale.
It is. They are huge.
Mammoth.
Absolutely massive. My favourite fact about a 15 megawatt turbine is that one rotation of a turbine can power a house for 2 days.
Wow.
Which is pretty phenomenal. Like, it just makes sense to build these things big offshore. They're further away from the coast, so they're much more... friendly from a stakeholder perspective, because they're much harder to see. They're in deeper water.
People on golf courses can't complain. I've got to look at a wind turbine. Anyway.
Yeah.
So you can go big. You can go big like fixed. Let's get some parlance right here. Did they call them fixed wind?
Fixed wind or fixed bottom.
Fixed bottom, right.
I often flip between terms and call it traditional offshore wind. And
trad wind.
All sorts of
things. Okay, right.
Trad wind. So, let's not make that a thing.
So you can go big just like those guys.
Yeah.
And then does this mean that there's a lot more wind power available to us in... as an island than typically? Or is the continental shelf around the UK pretty big and actually most of it is okay, it's fixed? For other countries, or is high wind for us? Not high wind. high wind, we'll talk about that in a minute. Is floating wind for other countries or for...
It's for everybody. Floating wind is for everyone. There's a massive opportunity globally. Most of the world's oceans are deep, really deep, and require... if they want to make the most of offshore wind, then it's going to require floating wind. So it absolutely suits the western seaboard of the UK around, the Celtic Sea. As I said, I haven't mentioned Ireland. Ireland's got very deep water as well. We're an Irish headquartered project company, and it will be of no surprise that we have projects that we're looking at off Ireland, different joint venture to the one I'm involved in. That's with Shell.
And the Irish are killing it. They're like, right, we're going 100% renewable tomorrow.
It's a lot of ambition.
Love it.
It's challenges. They've got similar challenges to, and we can talk about challenges in a moment, but they have challenges to the physical workings as well. But yeah, they're a committed bunch and want to see some big projects coming off. But there's all sorts of parts around the world. We've just announced a joint venture, or announced projects rather, in Sweden. We're looking at all sorts of other areas. We've submitted an application for a project in Poland. We've got a team over in the States who are looking at opportunities. By the time we finish recording, there'll probably be another announcement from us on another market that we're looking at, because there's so much opportunity for floating wind. It really is global. And it's a very exciting time to be part of it.
No, absolutely.
They're responsible for leasing the seabed. And we, as developers, are all readying ourselves now. For those of us that don't have leases or want more leases, we've got a 100 megawatt lease. We're about to be going in for a big 4 gigawatt leasing round.
Whoa.
Last time I checked, there are now 21 developers who are wanting a piece of that 4 gigawatts.
Wow.
And the intention...
Does that have a round number?
I don't know if we would call it round four or if we would call it round one, because it's... So the fixed offshore wind projects have gone up round 1 to 3. With some extensions mixed in there. sorry, no, there was a round four. This round four's already been, so round five. This could technically be round five, or it could be a new one because it's the first officially dedicated to floating wind.
They've been splitting rounds recently, haven't they? Four and then a letter and then a, who knows, right? How you want to split this up. And what about investors? Mm. Because right, in the world of batteries, we're always coming back to, we're battery geeks, right? It's only very recently that, I say recently in the grand scheme of things, that investors have got comfortable with the technology around batteries. Mm. And now it's like easy peasy, everyone's, and I say easy peasy, I'm being silly, but it's straightforward, right? Investors generally know what these things are, they get it, it's all right. But the floating wind thing, are investors comfortable with that as a technology yet? Or are they a little bit unsure?
I think they're, if they're not comfortable, they're very quickly getting comfortable. Yeah. There's, you know, we've, as I said, we've formed lots of joint ventures with people who've got, you know, lots of experience doing this sort of stuff. So doing deep water offshore projects like Total and Shell, and we've got another one with Ørsted. So people who do already understand this are comfortable with these sorts of projects. We're seeing lots of new entrants coming into the market, and we're seeing lots of diversification from other sectors as well. So I think people are comfortable because it is new, but it's not new. The turbines are the same. They've been being developed for a long while. And there is a lot of work to do on the foundation, the platform, if you like, and there's still lots and lots of different types of floating platform out there. But again, the oil and gas sector has been doing deep water floating projects for some time. So it's not completely new. It's just putting two bits together to create something. So I think there is confidence.
I know CFDs are very important to wind, right?
CFDs.
CFDs, which stand for
Contracts for Difference.
Contracts for Difference, right? And this is basically a mechanism so that I'll let you explain. Bridget did a really great job, so you've got to beat Bridget in less words. What is a CFD?
The CFD essentially is a way of giving certainty to the project developer that you are going to get a certain amount of money for your energy that you've generated. So it's done on strike prices, it's done in an auction, it's a competitive process, and it essentially promises you a price that you're going to get topped up to from where the wholesale price is. And if you go over that,
you have to give it back.
So you're going back into the public good. But it means that you can guarantee a certain revenue for your project. So it's important from a certainty point of view.
And will CFD strike prices for floating wind be higher or lower than trad wind?
Yeah, trad wind. Yes, they will be higher. And I'm glad you've asked the question because it's a really important point, actually. And it's something that those of us who are in the sector are talking about all the time. Just yesterday I was at an event and we were having a coffee and there were about eight of us just sort of talking about the challenges with the CFD here and the perception of the CFD publicly and in other parts of the renewable sector, because what's happened with fixed offshore wind is the strike price has got lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. And projects were originally looking at £155 per megawatt hour in the first sort of round. We're now down at something like £39 per megawatt hour. And it's dropped really quite
so
rapidly.
Cool. Yeah.
But
sorry.
It is cool.
Other wind types are available. Yeah.
But
that's impressive to get below 40 quid.
Impressive.
I mean,
it is fantastic. But there are lots of reasons that's happened. So fixed offshore wind is being developed and deployed. The first round in the UK was in 2000. We're now in 2022. So there's been 22 years there of development. The sites are shallow water. So that reduces your cost. You're not going as far offshore. You're not operating in as deep
conditions. Oh, it's not apples for apples. Yeah.
I would say it's not apples for apples. And I think where we're looking at these new areas like the Celtic Sea,
We love the Celtic Sea on this podcast right now. Celtic Sea is killing it.
It's where I do most. It's all my personal focus. Well, the company's got lots. That's my area. But the supply chain isn't developed there yet. The port infrastructure still needs to come along. And why that's important is when you do your CFD application, you're trying to get your costs as low as possible. And your costs are driven by your supply chain and by your installation methodologies and where you have to tow your turbines in from. If you are not able to make the best use of local supply chains, your costs are not going to be as cheap as areas like the East Coast of the UK, where there is now a very developed offshore wind community there. So the costs are also...
Should I start booing when we talk about the East Coast?
I love this.
If it's not Celtic, we're going to boo for it.
East Coast is great. But all of that, the very long-winded way to say that, yes, the costs absolutely will be higher, the strike prices for floating offshore wind, until we can start to deliver at scale and then drive that cost down. So I just think sometimes it's not particularly helpful to compare to fixed offshore wind on a cost point of view, because those sites are the low-hanging fruits. They're, as I said, they're the easy ones to develop, or easier. I don't think anyone who's developing them would say they're easy. Whereas we're looking at floating wind is breaking totally new ground, fantastic opportunities, but all of those things are going to have costs.
So if you guys are in deep water, does that mean there's less NIMBYs?
Oh, that's right.
Does that mean all the sort of the miseries who don't like to see offshore wind? No, that's a strong word, but I do mean it.
Yeah, I know.
They can just get on with it.
So it's much less visible because it's further offshore, so people can't necessarily see it. I think that there still would be concerns. People would feel, because again, the comparison to fixed wind, that people could still be worried that it could be a blight on the landscape. So there's good stakeholder engagement being done to educate and explain that actually these projects are further offshore and they bring benefits again. So jobs to areas that need development and need new jobs, new industry coming back. So I think people understand a bit more that there's opportunities as well as potentially concerns there. There are stakeholders that have real concerns about floating wind, and there's lots of work going on to sort that out. So the fishing industry, can be real concerns from them, because, you know, if you're going to be putting cables through areas that they want to fish.
What's the fish like in the Celtic Sea? Ooh, I don't know.
I'd have to check with my environmental colleagues on that one.
So fish, and I know the North Sea is pretty good for fishing.
But there is a very busy shipping industry there. But, you know, people do good work to ensure that you don't end up putting projects in the middle of really important fishing areas. So there's a lot of work to be done to avoid conflicts with other stakeholders and then to mitigate the risk as well. But
I'm going to ask a stupid question now. I can't believe it's taken me so long to ask. How does a floating wind turbine not fall over?
That's a very good question.
Obviously, it's got anchors, blah, 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 blah. I'm from Birmingham, so we have canal boats. That's the only boating experience we have. So, how do they not fall over?
So the platform that they're on is essentially ballasted so that it won't fall over. They're made either of, well, there's all sorts of designs for steel or concrete. So they're sort of specialist designed to ensure that they don't topple over in these conditions.
So big bit under the sea, which keeps it stable.
Well, for some of them, there are multiple types. And I'm, again, not an engineer, but the platforms that we're using at the moment are a semi-sub. So there's a bit under the water and a bit above.
Okay.
And it keeps it... keeps it stable. There are other types, but unfortunately, as I've said, not the engineer, so I can't go into masses of depth about how the inner workings of a...
Will it still be serviced by the same sort of boats, like working like wind cap vessels, like the ones that push on at full flat front? Is it the same operation?
Very similar O&M operation maintenance sort of processes for those. The installation methodology will be different. You can tow the turbines out as they are.
Oh, man.
Whereas with fixed wind, again, you'd take your barge full of monopiles out and you'd install the base piece and then you'd put your pile on. And
so you construct it onshore and like almost in a shipyard and then tow it out?
Yeah.
Nuts.
Yeah,
absolutely nuts.
Yeah. But it makes it interesting and it makes it challenging because it means that... your port infrastructure needs to have enough deep water, lay down space, long quays, all that kind of stuff to then do that onshore piece and then tow it out to location and then just, you know, stick it in.
Somewhere on the west of Wales is going to have a very deep port soon.
I hope so. That would make...
Where would it be serviced from in the Celtic Sea?
Well, it's a good question. Everybody is readying themselves at the moment. So the ports industry is really... wanting to be there to support the floating wind industry. At the moment, I think it's probably fair to say that nobody is quite ready yet, but there's big investments being made to, you know, increase the size of the laydown space, build new quays, make sure they've got the deep water that's required.
My money's on Barry. I used to work at Barry Power Station for a while. I love that place. Come on, Barry.
I know, we I didn't think the word Barry would come up in this podcast. You know, we talk a lot to Pembroke and to Port Talbot and others, but there's lots of opportunity for all of the ports in the Celtic Sea and further afield to kind of get ready.
Grimsby's smashing it, isn't it? Right. So the fishing port, Grimsby was kind of very sad what happened in Grimsby with fishing, right? we can blame all sorts of things, but certainly wasn't their fault.
Yeah.
And then, yes, the fishing industry died, pretty much almost died. And then out of nowhere came offshore wind servicing, and bam, Grimsby's like, all the hotels are full. Yeah. There's like loads of people traveling up there.
Yeah, it's,
got boats in and out all day. It's fantastic. So the winner in the Celtic Sea could have the same.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
But I think it'll be winners. I do think there'll be lots.
Winners.
Because there's lots, I don't think, so the scale of the opportunity is going to require a huge increase in the port infrastructure because, you know, our project, Erebus, the first one that we will be doing is 7 turbines. Mm-hmm. But as I said, if people think there's 50 gigawatts out there, even in the 4 gigawatt leasing round that's to come, we're doing 100 megawatts, which is a tenth of a gigawatt. That's 7 platforms and turbines. You know, scaling that up to the 4 gigawatt opportunity, it's Friday afternoon, I can't do the maths that quickly. There's a lot of turbines.
Yeah, there's a lot of turbines.
There's a lot of platforms. So there's a lot of opportunity.
Whenever anyone has to do maths on this podcast, it's wrong and it's completely rubbish. So
I just won't try, but...
Can we talk supply chains for a minute?
Yeah.
Right, because I know this is general windy stuff.
Yeah.
But so in the battery space, supply chain, everyone's talking about supply chains.
Yeah.
So rare earth metals, there's essentially like a proxy war going on between China and the States about buying up, you know, mines in the Congo and whatever. That's a podcast in its own. We should do that. But also, you know, productionizing and producing battery cells, there is not enough production capability out there. So how does it, and that's a real bottleneck because every country in the world is trying to build battery.
Yeah.
But the same is happening with wind, particularly islands or people who can do offshore. So what's supply chain look like for in the wind industry right now? Is it in turmoil? Like, I'm going to get told off for saying turmoil, but again, strong, but I believe it. Is it in turmoil like the battery world is?
It's a good question. And one that I'm probably not close enough to the real nitty gritty of the supply chain to actually answer. But I do know that everybody is trying to upscale. Everyone's trying to be ready for the opportunity and is you know, the demand currently does far outweigh what we can deliver. And there's lots of very clever people doing lots of things to try and change that by reducing the requirements for certain bits of, you know, materials that are required to build these things and reducing weight from projects so that you can, you know, just do them a bit more cheaply. And
yeah, weight must really matter, especially if you're floating.
I'm just glad I'm not an engineer having to deal with the calculations to make sure that these things all work out, because there's some very clever people on this
project. Do you need calm seas? Or can you, I assume you can't go and chop it. Or
yeah, it's really challenging. Again, you have weather windows are really important because you need to be able to get your kit out there safely. You need your people to be able to get it out there safely. So to tow it out, you do need a decent, you know, weather
window. We're probably
not
doing the middle of the Atlantic anytime soon.
I wouldn't have thought no. I told you it's not about the Celtic Sea.
It is about the Celtic Sea. Sorry for mentioning any other sea. And there's a few things. I've got some notes here that I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
And, we should have done some more prep, but the... The floating ecosystem. So there's, you guys are developing sites. You know, is there some big OEMs that are pushing this forward? What does that look like?
Yeah, all the OEMs are getting involved. And
so the Siemens and the GEs and those guys?
Yeah, all of those guys are all developing their turbines and being ready to start servicing the floating market, which will be new markets for them in most cases. But yeah, they're all behind it.
So it's not fixed versus floating. It's almost like an evolution of the...
Because the turbines are identical, I think. She says that very confidently without having checked that. They are pretty much identical. The integration between the turbine and the platform is the challenging bit, but the turbine is the same. So they're producing them and wanting to sell to project developers.
So the game is, right? I'm quite excited by this. So it's like we can access way more of the sea to put wind turbines on it. The game is we need to get costs down. So we need to build, learn, get costs
scale
down.
Scale up, get costs down.
I should have asked, we're really jumping around, but so there's projects already built, right?
There's a couple of small ones,
and is one of them called Highwind? Or did I just make that up, right? Okay, so me mentioning Highwind earlier was a Freudian slip, but not completely wrong. So what's Highwind about? Are you allowed to talk about Highwind?
It's not one of our projects.
Right, let's talk about one of yours then.
Well, we haven't built one yet.
Let's talk about Highwind then.
No, there are a few projects around that have built, and I think the maximum size is around 50 megawatts. There's the Kincardine project off Scotland, which is relatively close to shore for a floating wind project. Then there's going to be a project built, will hopefully be being built in just ahead of Erebus, which will be off the coast of Cornwall.
Yeah.
And this is by a company called, it's the Twin Hub project that Hexagon are doing. And then it's going to be Erebus that's going to come next is the plan. Our lovely 100 megawatt project, which will be the first in the stepping stones sort of approach here. Or we'll be building on the smaller stepping stones. And when I say stepping stones, it's a sort of, it's an approach that's being developed by the floating wind sector to suggest that we need to start smallish, and then upscale in a sustainable way to allow the supply chain to catch up. Because as we've said, you know, there's masses of competition here and the infrastructure's not quite there yet. So,
but surely we can tap into some of the oil and gas bonds who have been doing this for ages, right? These shipyards.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, we're not starting from scratch, which is good.
We're not, but in areas like the Celtic Sea,
there's got to be something musical we can...
Ding.
That's what that sounds. Yeah, anyway.
Which is, you know, my focus again. We haven't got quite the same oil and gas history. There is some oil and gas and the steel industry and such has been around it. But we haven't got quite the same infrastructure to tap into as you have up in other parts of the country. And the reason that matters, yes, arguably you could tow from further afield, but there's so many challenges with that. I mentioned weather windows. If you're coming across multiple, you know, bits of ocean, you've got different weather windows and different weather systems and such. And you lose all the local benefits then. And this is a real opportunity for development in areas that have previously maybe not benefited from fixed wind. So the Celtic Sea could benefit from having, you know, upscaling the infrastructure there and do homegrown work that we can then export as well.
You managed to do that without saying the words levelling up. I actually think was very, very well played.
Try to avoid sound bites. But
yeah.
It's true too.
I want to make sure to ask you a couple more questions, and I'm going to tell you what they are in advance. So the first one is about opportunities. So if this thing takes off, which it looks like it will, what does that mean that's different to what we have at the moment? Mm. Second one is more of like a battery-ish question, which is, if you're in deeper seas, and I think you get higher wind yield, is that the word? Wind spread?
Yeah.
Wind
yield? Efficiency,
Does that mean that you're more dispatchable and you can participate in balancing services better? You know, there's less intermittency. Mm. Does that mean we could class floating wind in deeper seas as a higher reliable amount of inertia? We won't talk about inertia, but does this mean that the blades will spin more?
Yeah, so the wind is more consistent in deeper waters, so you can absolutely extract more from a project, which is great. And that's it, you know, I think that it will give you that very constant flow back. In terms of batteries, controversially for this office, I'm not a battery expert, so I don't think I could comment on whether or not it would operate in balancing services. But what I would say is that floating wind, lots of developers now are looking at ways to overcome grid challenges and what you could do with that, with your power, if you can't get it into the grid, because it's one of the biggest challenges at the moment to floating offshore wind
and offshore Bitcoin mining, that's what we're doing.
In general. So lots of people are looking at things like hydrogen or building battery storage into their projects in order to not lose the opportunity. So there's lots of people looking at that and different models to make the project stack up, particularly when you can't connect into the grid or can connect into the grid, but it's much more challenging.
Yeah. Okay. And then now here's the plug, right? So you now, Kerry, represent the whole offshore floating wind industry.
No pressure then.
What's the opportunity here?
And the opportunity is huge. There's many opportunities, you know, globally with the hundreds and hundreds of gigawatts that we could deploy here. And the UK has got a fantastic opportunity to go first to capture benefits, all sorts of benefits around our coasts. So jobs, many of them. I think Renewable UK, who represent the renewables industry, reckon that we need another 100,000 people working in offshore wind by 2030.
Wow.
5,000 welders. I love that fact.
Yeah, that's
a lot of welders, right? There's huge opportunities for jobs for everybody. At all levels, you know.
Not necessarily in Birmingham, though.
Not necessarily in Birmingham.
We're going to move to the coast.
Yeah. But there's opportunities, yeah, for our ports to, you know, benefit from this, for people to benefit from it. green energy. Like, you know, we're in a climate crisis. We've got net zero to go for. The government has set a target for floating wind of 5 gigawatts by 2030, which is extremely challenging, but a target is welcomed. And it will, you know, we fully expect offshore wind to become the backbone of the energy system.
That's a lot. Yeah. Five gigs in the next 8 years.
Yeah. That's when, like, keeping us all up at night.
I don't know, have they even consented for 5 gigs?
No, so at the moment, I mentioned, obviously, the Crown Estate, so we're going, the Celtic Sea leasing round will happen in early next year, and there'll be 4 gigs from that. We just had ScotWind, mm-hmm. Which was quite widely reported as, you know, they got, I think it was something like, it was 18 gigawatts that they leased. And I think half of that was floating, or 10 was floating. But these projects have really long development pathways at the moment, and that has to come down to get anywhere near that target.
18 gigs in ScotWind and half it's like, who's, mm-hmm. where are all these people going to come from?
I know. I mean, it's like, the biggest challenge facing us as an industry is recruitment. And there's such a gap between the ambition and where these people are.
How are you going to get everyone?
It's really challenging. It's honestly,
we thought batteries was hard.
Yeah,
enough.
It's the thing that is, every event I go to at the moment, every meeting I'm in, every developer I talk to, every part of the supply chain I talk to, we are all saying the same thing. We just can't recruit quickly enough because everybody wants to be part of this. But there's a, you know, the ambition is well ahead of the, where we are with people at the moment. So it is really hard. But also that presents an opportunity in that people from the oil and gas background or ex-military or all sorts of other sectors that
can come in and bring
their transferable skills and, you know, convert them. And I think, you know, there are masses of opportunities for people who want to get in on the green revolution.
This is probably a good time to, we haven't talked about net zero and the targets, right? So what are the targets for offshore wind?
So offshore wind has now got a 50 gigawatt target by 2030. That was 40 gigs and it was 30 gigs and it kind of keeps incrementally increasing by 10 gigs at a time. And floating wind is now 5 gig out of that 50. So 45 for fixed.
45 trad, 5 floating.
Floating. And that was 1 gigawatt.
And what do we have right now?
Recently. In the UK, I think max of,
putting you on the spot here,
max,
sorry,
of 100 meg max across a couple of small projects.
Oh, sorry, I mean, like across all, it's like 20 gigs of wind.
Oh, sorry, for including fixed. Yeah. I think it's, I don't think it's quite as much as 20 now. I think it's around,
so we've got
20.
A long way to go.
Really long.
It's funny, like, just politicians picking numbers out. It's just like,
So it's, yeah.
I'm backing it. Like, if we can make 50 work. But.
Yeah. And I think targets are helpful because it does give you something to work against as a backdrop. And it's helpful in that it really focuses the mind. There are lots of challenges that need to be ironed out. I've mentioned grid. There are real challenges with the grid. We know it needs upgrading. There's, at the moment, going through the offshore transmission network review, which instead of in sort of previous times, all projects would just connect point to point in a radial connection. That would mean lots and lots of cables onshore, lots of connections onshore. And they're now trying to review that to make sure that we're a bit more coordinated. But that's a challenge.
So you have hubs of big cables coming in.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
And are we all right? So is he the producers just wandering around, which usually means that something's broken, but we seem to be okay. It's good.
Okay. The risk of not doing this is too great. You know, we know climate change is a thing. You know, we are, as you say, boiling the oceans, warming our planet. We have to take action now. The threat from climate change is bigger than the threat from COVID. It's bigger than the threat from anything else that we currently
face. It's not bigger than the threat from bureaucracy, which is possibly the biggest threat to humankind.
Potentially.
Preventing extinction ever.
So, you know, there's a massive opportunity. There's a massive ambition. We've got a massive target. We now need to work some of those bits of the puzzle out in order to enable the deployment at the pace that we need it to go.
Well, let's do it. I'm buzzing.
I'm
with floating
too.
Wind for the win. All right, anything else you want to plug before
anything
we finish?
Else I want to plug?
This is your chance.
My chance. I mean, I've never been known to have a conversation in the renewable space without mentioning my personal bugbear, which is around the lack of gender diversity in the sector. It's something I'm deeply passionate about. And I think it's an opportunity with floating wind now that we can try and reinvent the sector slightly. We don't have to keep doing what we've always done. Floating wind isn't doing what we've always done. And we can try and make sure we build a much more inclusive industry. And I focused on gender because that's the bit I most feel most qualified to comment mm-hmm. on. Clearly, there needs to be much better inclusion across the population. We absolutely cannot get to net zero, 5 gigawatts, 50 gigawatts, whatever number you want to throw, without engaging the full weight of the population. It's just,
so we need 2,500 female welders.
That's what we need. That makes me so happy.
to do this.
Yeah. And we need everybody there. We need, you know, I've mentioned so many problems. Problems need solving. They need creative thinking. They need to do things differently. People need to do things differently. Therefore, we need to bring in different people from different backgrounds and different ways of doing things. And I think it's a fantastic opportunity we've got to engage, you know, much more of the population than we currently do. So that's something I just literally can't remember the last time I had a conversation publicly or anything anywhere without discussing gender balance.
No. So thanks for bringing it up.
I have to bring it up.
No, well, I think we can do it. So it's a fresh start. Let's do it. One last thing to ask you. So, do you think 50 is going to happen by 2030?
50 will definitely happen. 2030 will be a challenge unless some of the things that I mentioned can be sorted out at pace to unblock some of the systems. So, as I said, planning has to be managed well, but we also have to build projects. So we've got to find a way to reduce planning timeframe. You know, the review around the grid has to happen, but it's got to happen much more quickly. We've got to invest in the infrastructure onshore in order to be able to bring these projects back on. You know, we've got to invest in our ports now. We've got to start upskilling those people. We've got to find these welders. So we've got to be, you know,
it's a
coordinated effort to put all the bits of the puzzle together to drive as far and as fast as we can towards that 2030 target. So I'm, you know, cautiously optimistic.
I think the government, this is my last
if
rant.
They're listening.
I think the government, well, yes, Boris, you. I think we need so many people to move out of other industries into, like, there's a fixed population, right? We need to move so many people over to building green stuff.
Yeah.
I think the government, because it's in the spirit of creating money from thin air at the moment, we should create money from thin air and give bonuses to people who move into the wind sector, the offshore wind sector. Particularly in the Celtic Sea, but especially
women. No,
particularly women. Yeah, but why not?
You know, I think
radical thinking, right?
Yeah, you jest, but we do need to incentivize the sector. We need to be advocates for the sector so that people realize what an amazing place it is to work. We're doing really cool stuff. Not only is it good for the planet, it's cool. It's great big bits of kit that one turbine rotation can power a home for 2 days. Like, that's cool. I think it's cool anyway. I might need to get out more. Yeah. But, you know, we do really need to make people realise what an attractive place it is to work and doing good stuff. And the breadth of opportunities. You know, there's, in our organisation alone, we've got people with legal backgrounds, environmental backgrounds. We've got engineers. We've got, you know, social sciences. We've got, you name it. We've got it. And I think that's the point with the renewable sector and floating wind in particular. There's something for everyone, whatever the skill set is, to come and make that, and, you know, have that contribution. So
I 100% agree. Right, so we're gonna do it. We've run out of time. Thank you so much for coming on, Kerry. So anyone who's listening, watching, however you're consuming this, please do let us know. We've had loads of feedback recently from people watching and listening. Let us know, comment, subscribe, and we'll see you next time. Thanks very much
for having me.